was haunted by my predecessor's library. When he left the parish that I now minister in, he left the ministry, and so he left his library behind. I recognised on the shelves of his library the pattern of his ministry over the previous 15 years. His books were divided thematically, not according to doctrine, but according to trends. There was there a spurt of books on church growth principles, and then a spurt on charismatic ministry, and then a spurt on the next trend, and so on and so forth. People in the congregation confirmed that he had tried every one of these as they had become the in thing. Tried and failed. He had found nothing to sustain his ministry. On my first day, as I looked around his library and realized what this endless pursuance of trend-driven ministry had produced, I resolved to have a ministry shaped by Jesus Christ and Him alone. David Hanson would not be the only pastor to find in a predecessor's library such a pattern of books. And there is no shortage of books, should we want them, on the bookshelf of Wesley Owen or somewhere else, other appropriate bookshop, on church leadership. It's a hugely expansive growth industry. You can find books on leading churches in all sorts of places, with all sorts of themes: transitioning your church, gearing churches for growth, leading your church into third millennium ministry, books on management in the church, books on psychology for the church, books on group dynamics. They're always there, and there's always new ones to be read. Our subject tonight is about leadership. And the interesting thing is that when you turn to the Bible and what it says about leadership, it says very little about the things that all the authors are writing about today. It speaks much more about character as the primary qualification, and call as the main criteria for what we should look for in leaders. So with due respect to Julie Andrews, who wisely sang that we should start at the beginning, for it's a very good place to start, I want us to start at the end, or near the end tonight, because I think it's when we understand the nature of the church, when we begin to have a biblical doctrine of the church, that we'll understand the nature of church leadership, and we'll appreciate the Bible's guidelines on church leadership. And that's why I want us to dip into verse 15 before we go back and look at the earlier verses in chapter 3, where Paul, in the course of his writing, seems to use three different images of the church. Now, there are many more than that in the New Testament. These happen to be the ones in this chapter, and it seems to me important that we grasp them to appreciate what else he's saying. You see them there? You will know how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and foundation of the truth. God's household, God's family, God as Father and as His brothers and sisters. It's a relational picture. It's a people picture. Not a business picture, people picture. Church of the living God, the assembly of the living God, the called out ones, the separated off ones, perhaps. An Old Testament image, actually. Those called out to be the people amongst whom God would dwell and make Himself known. People characterized by the living God being in the midst. And thirdly, the pillar and foundation of the truth. This is an unusual phrase. It's not without controversy in its interpretation. And it's unusual as an image of the church, because we would tend to think, and the rest of the scriptures, New Testament, would teach that the truth is the foundation of the church. But here it seems to say that the church is the pillar and foundation of the truth. What's Paul saying? Well, the word literally means a kind of buttresses of the truth. We have them here, you know, holding the building up. And probably in Paul's mind is the image that Timothy and other Christians in Ephesus would have been familiar with, of the temple of Diana, with 100 columns — that's Diana of Ephesus, not Diana of Wales — 100 columns holding up the massive marble roof on the top of the temple. And he's saying, in effect, understand, that's what you're about as a church. You're there to display the truth. You're the pillars on which the truth of the gospel, and as he goes on to speak, the truth of Jesus Christ, the mystery of godliness, you're there. That's your function. To hold it up. To exhibit it. To make it known in the world. And I think that's really where that beautiful summary of the work and life of Jesus that he quotes there at the end of the chapter comes in. It's related to that truth that we are to hold up. Now, out of these three images, we want to affirm these things very simply about the church. The church, whose leaders we're thinking about tonight, is God's church. Not mine, not yours, not anyone's, but God's. And at the very most, you and I are caretakers. In fact, that very word is used. If you look down at verse 5, if anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? How can he be a caretaker of God's church? I don't know if you've ever been asked to take care of anything precious for anybody, but imagine if someone wanted someone to take care of the crown jewels. They wouldn't give it to any Tom, Dick and Harry, would they? They would look for suitably qualified people of the right character and trustworthiness. Well, how infinitely more precious is the Church of Jesus Christ, the jewels which will be the crowning glory of Jesus in eternity. And God has his caretaker for those jewels. So we would expect, would we not, serious consideration and high qualification and significant character to be in those as to be the past. I don't know if you've ever been asked to take care of anyone else's children. Some of you go to SU camp, I suppose, are in that sense house parents for a week. I've never been there. I was going to say I've never been asked to go to SU camp. I better not say that, because someone sitting in the audience will probably ask me tonight if I say that. I've never been to an SU camp as a leader. I have once been a house parent to primarily children of prisoners from Belfast and from the Troubles, on a holiday for them in Northern Ireland. I was very young at the time, and I thought it was a most serious thing. I was very nervous of taking care of someone else's children for the week. More nervous than I was of taking my own. Maybe I should be more nervous of taking care of my own. Here we are, caretakers of God's household. Those for whom Christ died. Those whom he is beautifying by his Spirit. And leaders in the church are caretakers of the household. So the church is God's church, and that puts a different perspective on all our thinking about who is to be a leader and how we're to recognise leaders in the church. Secondly, I think it's important to say that because the church is God's church, God has a blueprint for leadership. Elders are not something, you know, that the reformers thought up. They're not even something that Paul and the apostles thought of. Elders and leaders of God's people are really there, right through the scriptures. You go back as far as Moses, and you find reference to them in the time of the judges, and in 2 Kings, and in the prophets, and so on and so forth. People appointed by God to lead his people. And I think that's very significant for us, and should caution us that before we rush the modern manuals on leadership and all that they might teach us, we ought to familiarize ourselves with the blueprint of the one whose church we are seeking leaders for, and who himself has provided leadership for his church. One of two things we maybe want to say, just in general terms, that are partly here in this passage and partly come from elsewhere in the New Testament about biblical leadership. First of all, I think we would want to say that the Bible seems to recognize, first of all, that leadership in the church is a plural thing. Nowhere in the New Testament is there any indication of individuals being given leadership over the local congregation. It always seems to imply that there are several leaders in any congregation, and that would be therefore maybe the first principle we want to put alongside our concern for biblical leadership in the church, that it should be exercised by a plurality of people. Secondly, equality amongst leaders. There's no hierarchy amongst the leadership of the church. You will probably be familiar that in the New Testament there are two words primarily used for leaders of the church, and they're the two words that we get our most familiar forms of church government from, episcopal and presbyterian. The words are episkopoi and presbyteros, and they generally are interpreted or translated, in the New Testament as bishop and elder. But you don't need to read very far in the New Testament to realize that these terms seem to be used interchangeably, that they're not referring to two different offices. They're referring, in fact, sometimes they're used in the same passage of the same group of people. And so we might suggest, I think, helpfully, that they refer to different aspects. Elder perhaps refers something to the character of the office. Bishop, overseer, to the function of the office. But they're not talking about two different offices, one more significant than the other. The New Testament seems to teach equality amongst the leadership. Yes, there may be differentiation in function, but there's no distinction in authority between what we call in the Reformed Church a teaching elder and a ruling elder. Equality amongst the leaders. We probably want to say a word or two about the distinction here in this passage between elders and deacons. You'll see that distinction is made in the first few verses. We're speaking about overseers or elders, bishops. Further down, Paul is speaking about deacons. The word sometimes is used in the New Testament in general terms of Christian ministry, in terms of service, diaconal ministry. But it also seems to be applied in some of these pastoral epistles to a particular office in the New Testament church that sometimes is identified with practical and social caring. But I think it's fair to say that it's not always clear what form that ministry took. I think we do want to say, and we can say as much, we can say this with quite clear certainty from this passage, that we're certainly not talking about a spiritual ministry and a temporal ministry in the sense of a non-spiritual ministry. You can tell I'm coming on to some difficult material. I'm nervous. Both elders, overseers and deacons are described in the character they're looking for in terms of spiritual qualities and spiritual character. So we mustn't think that somehow spiritually equipped people should be shoved in this direction, and those who happen to be around the church who show leadership ability, but
There isn't really much. Talk among yourselves.
Distinction between people who have a spiritual quality and are therefore eligible for one type of ministry and people who are not spiritual and eligible for another. That's not the distinction. Both require spiritual people because they're spiritual tasks. For myself, I'm not even sure the distinction is between a kind of a word-based ministry and a social-based ministry. It seems to me the distinction may be more between the kind of permanent role in leadership in the church and a more designated, task-orientated role of leadership. So in our setup, we sometimes speak of the members of the Kirk Session as being elders and the members of the Congregational Board as being deacons, but I think it would be right to speak of those who have responsibility for leadership in Sunday school, for example, as having a diaconal ministry. I think it would be right to speak of the Moody'sburn team set apart for a particular task in the church as having a diaconal ministry. I think it would be right to speak of the praise leader at the organ as having a diaconal ministry. The exercise leadership in the church, but it's slightly different. And it's an assistance, it's an outworking in the practical realms of the church of what the elders shape and guide in terms of the overall leadership of the whole church. They would have responsibility in part for one area, and the elders perhaps for the broader picture. That seems to me a usable distinction here. Then I think we better say something about the male and female leaders. I listened to the tape from last week. I heard what was said about the allocation of these chapters. And, well, that's just the privilege of making up the rota. But let me say one or two other things. I think what Martin said was very helpful and very balanced and very faithful to Scripture. And neither of us find these passages easy. It's easy if you want to go down the line of kind of wooden literalism. But if you want to be faithful to what God is saying in His Word, you want to be faithful to that word and seek to apply it in our generation as He is seeking to lead us by His word to do. It's not an easy task. I think it would be a cop-out to say absolutely nothing, but I don't want it to be a distraction for tonight. Martin very helpfully distinguished between what seems to be in the created order of God and is unchanging and what are the cultural expressions of that in generation and may change from generation to generation. And if I heard the address right on the tape, Martin highlighted the principle of headship as something that seems to be rooted in the biblical order in creation, but the outworking of that in some of what Paul says in chapter 2 in terms of how women are to dress or in terms of silence in church and so on as cultural expressions of that for that time and not necessarily the appropriate cultural expressions for our time. So does what Paul say in this chapter imply that leadership is always male? There seems to be an assumption, since he speaks of people who are overseers as being husbands, that they will be male. And it seems to have been the practice of the New Testament church. Yet I think there's more to it than that. If you look down at verse 11, for example, and most of our translations have, in the same way, their wives are to be women. That word there is open to some dispute as to whether it says their wives are to be women, or whether it says in the same way, women are to be worthy of respect, and whether Paul in that place is actually speaking of women rather than the wives of those he has just been speaking of. And certainly, at least in the case of Phoebe, there seems to have been one recognized deacon in the church, referred to in Romans 16, verse 1. In terms of leadership in the church, it seems to me that depending on your starting point, you may come to different conclusions. Let me take, for example, that verse that was read last week, verse 11, that says a woman should learn in quietness and full submission. Now, there is one way to read that verse that sounds quite limiting, if the emphasis is put on in quietness and full submission. But if the emphasis is put on a woman should learn, it's a very radical verse. And the radicalness of it is encouraging women to learn in a society where women were not thought worthy of learning, where women did not go to school and were not taught. Now clearly, in that kind of society where women are not taught, there would be no question of women being leaders in the church. How can you have untaught people leading the church? But if women are taught and have come to learn the truth of the faith submitted to you, are we in a different place? And then I think if you approach the question of leadership in the church from the perspective of some of the things Jesus says on leadership, again, different questions arise in our minds. You know, says Jesus to the disciples, that those regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be the first must be the slave of all. There seems to be a contrast there between leadership that is exercised by lording it over people and imposing your authority on them, and leadership that is exercised through humble service. And in the community of Jesus, he is saying that leadership is to be exercised by humble service. Some would find it strange if women, as well as men, would not want, in obedience to Christ, to aspire to humble service. And it seems to me that perhaps brings a different focus to the debate, in the sense that it's often focused on the issue of authority. And I wonder if there are other issues to be considered. One other comment that plays on my mind quite a bit, and that is in relation to our authority as leaders of the church. It seems to me that we are in a different place from the New Testament church, in the sense of the New Testament is now complete. And my whole authority, and my only authority as a Christian leader, comes from my humble submission to Scripture. And whenever I depart from it, it seems to me my authority has gone. Lost. I have no authority in the church. The authority does not come from my office. It comes from my submission to the authority of God's word. And when one begins to think along those lines, again, it seems to me it raises different questions. Now, all I'm doing is raising issues that are constantly in my mind, it has to say, and I think are an ongoing issue in the evangelical community. I don't think you need to be Solomon to recognise that in the way Martin and I speak about it, there are probably slightly different nuances in the way that we read things. And that doesn't particularly worry me. What I rejoice in is that the issue is not of such centrality that we cannot find common cause in the gospel, and we cannot live and work in the same congregation. And I rejoice in that ability to work in the gospel work, to recognise the things that are absolutely essential that we agree on, and to recognise the possibility of the diversity in things that are less essential. I'm not seeking to answer these questions, I'm simply raising questions that I think need to be asked of these passages as we seek to interpret them for today. The main things we want to speak about, and the things I want you to take away about, and to talk about, and to pray about, are not these issues particularly. It's what I'm about to say concerning the qualifications of leadership. for more than anything else today, these should be our concern. And I want to suggest that we look at them under three headings. That those who would be leaders in the Church of God should be marked firstly by personal integrity. Sorry, I'm doing them in a different order. Marked firstly by spiritual maturity. The word elder in the Old Testament has somewhere in its root in the Hebrew the idea that an elder is a bearded one, one able to grow a beard. Now that probably rules out quite a few of us already. It does not imply elderly, but it implies maturity, and it carries with it the idea that wisdom and maturity normally comes with the years. Normally, I say, but not exclusively, because Paul says later on to Timothy, don't let anyone look down on you because you're young, chapter 4 verse 12, but set an example for the believers in speech, in life, in love, in faith and in purity. The root of the word suggests that wisdom and maturity appropriate for leadership normally comes with years. But it doesn't automatically come. And we all know that. We know people that are in their 60s that are still have the mentality of teenagers. And we know teenagers who I wasn't thinking of anyone in particular. We know teenagers who, like Timothy, we can rightly say, don't let anyone look down on you because you're young. But set an example in speech and life and purity. Did you know that there's only one qualification to be the President of the United States? To be eligible to be the President of the United States? Do you know what it is? Are you an American? Nope. Eh? Nope. Exactly. You have to be over 35 to be the President of the United States. Now, in recent history, you may think that's not a very significant qualification, and they ought to add one or two others, but that's the way it is. And it carries within it the idea, surely, it's there, that somewhere wisdom and maturity comes with the passing of the years, and therefore we shouldn't be looking for someone too young. Now, I think we want to add to that that in the New Testament, it's not simply a question of maturity, but spiritual maturity. We've already said we're concerned in the church with God's work, with God's people, with God's truth. And therefore it is a spiritual work and it needs spiritual maturity. And if we're to understand what the leaders are about, we need to understand that at the core of the church's work are therefore spiritual priorities. And that's why Paul, I think, on this aspect of the need for spiritual maturity for leaders highlights the danger of a recent convert being appointed. Verse 6. He must not be a recent convert. A newly planted one, it literally means. One's reminded of the parable of the sower of Jesus. And the warning there that initial response is not proof of deep roots. Plant needs to put down roots significantly and drink significantly and be nurtured significantly before it begins to produce fruit, lasting fruit. I heard recently of a church in Ireland where someone came into the congregation, was converted, a really significant conversion in the sense that no one had any doubts of the transformation of this person's life. And he was a very financially astute person, and within 18 months he was made treasurer and elder in the church. Many gifts were desirable and helpful to that congregation. But in time it proved that he was spiritually immature, and it was an inappropriate appointment. Because in a time of panic, when he was unsure about the finances, the way he dealt with it was dishonest. And one might say that a sturdier plant, a plant with deeper roots, a plant with more ripe fruit would have reacted differently to the circumstances, where honesty was at the very core of his being as he grew up in Christ. and he would have saved himself and the congregation a lot of anxiety and painful soul searching. And maybe not his fault, the congregation's fault. The key task of leadership is example. Peter, writing in the 5th chapter, says, be an example to the flock of God. Literally, be God's samples. And if the work of God is barely begun in someone, then to put pressure of providing example on them is an unfair and unwise thing to do. You wouldn't do it in any other place. Imagine the gymnastics class that Zoe goes to. Imagine there's a display on the Friday evening, and this girl comes in on the Monday. It's the first time she's ever been at the gymnastics class, and she does fantastically well. But would you put her at the front of the display on the Friday evening as an example to the others? I read somewhere recently that your muscles, in order to produce the same action under pressure, need to have learned that action 5,000 times. That's why Colin Montgomery does 5,000 shots every day on the practice range, so that under pressure he can crack up. No, under pressure he can produce the same shot. And you wouldn't put a young gymnast who's only done the exercise 2 or 3 times and our muscles haven't learned to do it, so that if, in case the adrenaline was flowing on the night, the muscles responded differently and she did differently. Now, if you wouldn't do it for such an inconsequential thing as that, would you ask a new Christian in whom their spiritual muscles are only just beginning to be exercised to take on a role that involves key example? Unwise. Very unwise. Thirdly, in this area, spiritual maturity, elders have to be able to teach. I'm not even looking at the right chapter at the moment. Verse 2, able to teach. Now, we have in our tradition this distinction between ruling elders and teaching elders, but it's not a kind of either or thing here in the New Testament. And Paul says here that all elders should be able to teach. Now, that doesn't mean that all elders will have a pulpit ministry, or all elders are set apart for a full-time ministry of the word. But if the primary task of the elder is pastoral, and it is, we are under shepherds of the sheep, under shepherds of the great shepherd, then a shepherd who can pat his sheep on the back and say, nice sheep, but hasn't a clue what makes good food for them, is not really much of a shepherd at all. And so the elders are called on to be able to teach. And to be able to teach, one needs to be taught oneself. One needs to be well taught, and one needs to be continuously taught. So that in different places and in different ways, an elder can feed the flock. Maybe an elder goes into a home, wouldn't be unknown in this parish even, and say, and the person in the home says, I don't have a clue what that guy in the pulpit says. I don't know what he's going on about. And an elder should be able to say, well, let me open the scriptures for where we were on Sunday, and let's go through it together, and let's see if we can learn from it. An elder should be able to teach. And that might be exercised amongst children or teenagers or adults. It might be exercised in a group context or in a one-to-one context. But they should be sufficiently familiar with the truth of the gospel that we've to hold on, sufficiently confident in it to be able to open it up and explain it to others. So you'll understand when I say the criteria listed here, first of all, it seems to me focus around the need for spiritual maturity. Let me just highlight one other thing on that caught my eye this week in James chapter 5. A chapter that will be familiar to many of you, and the chapter where it says that if any of you are sick, he should call the elders of the church to pray over him and anoint him with oil in the name of the Lord. Why is that? Why the elders? Is it because there's an assumption there that the elders will be doctors? That they will have the gifts of healing? You know what I think the reason is? I think it's an assumption that the elders will be praying people and will be committed to prayer. That there will be no doubt that these will be people who will be happy, delighted, set apart to pray for you, because that is at the core of their being. Call the elders of the church to pray. Spiritually mature people, able to teach, given to prayer. Secondly, and we will move a bit quicker now that my throat's better, people of personal integrity. They are to be above reproach, says Paul. They are to be temperate, they are to be self-controlled, respectable, not given to drunkenness, nor a lover of money, neither having a good reputation with outsiders. What Paul seems to be saying in a variety of different ways here is the need for consistent personal character for elders. Who I am matters more than what I do. I may have learned all the skills necessary in the best training and top management company in the country. I may have great experience as the director of an international company. I may be popular and persuasive with a charismatic personality. But to paraphrase scripture, if I have not love, I am nothing. If I have not fruit of the Spirit in evidence in my life, I have nothing to give. If I live not in step with the Spirit, I can give nothing. Personal integrity. You see, it seems to me that at the heart of this is the evidence of God's Spirit and the fruitfulness that comes from his activity in their lives. Self-control, not given to drunkenness, not a lover of money. If I live by the flesh, I may make decisions about the life of the church for all the wrong reasons. I may make them out of spite. I may make them out of favoritism. I may make them out of personal comfort. I may make them out of self-interest. But if I am walking in step with the Spirit, if myself is under control of the Spirit, then I have something to contribute to. Motives are very important in Christian service, you know. Paul says here he must not be a lover of money, and Peter says in his chapter on leadership, not greedy for money. These are to do with our motives. And again, this would be the danger of kind of too literalistic an interpretation of these words, because I'm sure it would be right to substitute in place of these things. Not a lover of popularity. I'm not a lover of the easiness. So many things that go hand in glove with these kind of attributes in terms of personal integrity. I've said before, and I want to say again, in the way that we govern the church, what an elder does at a church session meeting is, in my mind, one of the least important things he does. And that's why the issue of personal integrity is so important. If it was just a question, if it was just a question of turning up at a church session meeting and contributing well, and dare I say it for myself, if it is just a question of turning up on a Sunday and saying the right things at the front and performing in the public eye,
too easy.
It's what we are in the life of the congregation. It's what we are at prayer. It's what we are in the congregation at worship. It's what we are in service. It's what we are when the church is gathered on a Sunday. It's what we are when the church is scattered on a Monday to a Friday. It's then and there, as much as in the core leadership meeting, that leadership is exercised, that leaders are examples to the flock. It's what we are in the home of our neighbour, in the congregation. It's what we are over a cup of coffee with a new convert. And that's why this whole aspect of personal integrity is so laboured on here. Personal integrity. Thirdly, I want to say, I think, relational credibility is a third aspect that Paul highlights. The husband of but one wife, controversial verse, not least, not only for the reasons I highlighted earlier on the male-female issue, but on whether they're excluding men who are not married or men who are widowed and remarried and so forth. I think the most straightforward reading is the simplest and the best, and it seems to simply be speaking of the need for faithfulness in relationships. Hospitable, open to others. Again, we wouldn't say necessarily that that means that only those with their own homes who can open their own homes should be elders. That's about the way we are in our lives, about how much space we give to others and welcome we give to others. Not violent, but gentle. Not quarrelsome. These are all words to do with our relationships. It seems to be that we need people who are relationally credible, demonstrating in the areas of life which reflect the family nature of the church the qualities needed to lead in a family. That's why much is made of how we manage our own families before we manage in the church of God. Now, we recognise different personality types, and we thank God for the great diversity of personality types, and life is so much richer for the rainbow. But I think we need to say that if we're leaders in the church and that we're awkward, cumbersome, cold and difficult, we not only do a great discouragement to the people of God, but we do a great disservice to the gospel. There needs to be, in the quality of our relationships, a life that adorns the doctrine we declare and the family we're called to love. Spiritually mature, personally full of integrity, marked by relational credibility. Let me finish with three thoughts. Leadership is something we ought to honour. It's God's idea for God's people. God's people need leadership. And just as it's disastrous in the home if children lose respect for parents, so in the church, if we lose respect for leadership, it is disastrous. Just think of Moses and his people in the desert and all their complaints and all the disasters that befell. And I think this is probably the biggest challenge of our time when it comes to leadership issues in the church. In a society when cynicism is rife and anti-authoritarianism is the relative who calls most frequently in many houses, and self-assertiveness is the most oversubscribed night class in many colleges, submission is a Christian grace that is called for in us all. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And one of the expressions of that God-ordained quality for all our lives, submission, is to our God-appointed leaders in the church.
And I think that's a very important thing to say for those of you who stand light the church membership. If you're not a member of this church or any other church, who are you submitting to? And how are you expressing that call to submit to leaders in the church? We all need the grace of God to enable us to be. But if we're going to honour leadership as a gift of God, we need to honour the leaders He gives us.